RN, your travelling companion.
And hello, welcome to Life Matters. Yes, as our summer season puts away its beach umbrella for another year, scrapes off the zinc cream, pulls the sand out of every crevice. Okay, I'm taking it a bit far there. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Good morning to you wherever you are, however you're spending this Australia Day. Really looking forward to you spending the next hour with us and to bringing you a year of freshly minted shows at this time each weekday. And we certainly want to hear from you. The issues you're itching to hear covered on Life Matters, send us your story ideas whenever they come to mind. Guests you'd really love us to consider, you can email via our website. And all the other usual ways, tweet us at RN Life Matters, message us on Facebook, our listener line for your calls and feedback, 02833 1430. 24 hours a day, let it rip. And this Australia Day, who calls Australia home? Striking stories of starting out. And first up, the Australia Day honours list has landed, and there's a surfing legend in its midst. But if you know something of Lane Beachley's incredible life story, you'll know it takes her well beyond those killer, killer waves. Lane has been awarded an AO this year. She is considered the most successful female surfer in history, the only person, male or female, to claim six consecutive world titles, which she did in her mid-20s, and she went on to win her seventh world title, seven, in 2006, before retiring from the world tour in 2008. These days she lives on Sydney's northern beaches with her hubby, musician and In Excess band member Kirk Pengilly, and her many pursuits include serving on the board of Surfing Australia and directing her own charity, which we'll hear about, the Lane Beachley Aim for the Stars Foundation. Lane Beachley, welcome to Life Matters. Congrats on the AO.
Oh, yes, I know. It's amazing. I'm still in shock.
Yet another award. Where are you going to put this one?
Well, it's a I believe it's just a pin, not a trophy, because Kirk would kill me if I brought another trophy home. But we do have a trophy room.
Your dad, Neil, must be mighty proud, though, because this is recognition, not just by the surfing fraternity, the sporting fraternity, but by the entire nation.
Yeah, he is immensely proud. I think when I told him, he went into a state of shock, much like I did when I received the letter from the Governor-General. So I know he's going to be standing tall and proud with tears in his eyes at the ceremony whenever that occurs, but he is immensely proud, as am I, incredibly proud and very satisfied.
Your world, as people will know, has expanded well beyond surfing now, and we'll get to that. Let's start with surfing, though, if we can. Mm-hmm. And I am interested in how you see things being different for the champions on the circuit today, like Steph Gilmore and Sally Fitzgibbons and Tyler Wright, compared to what you were experiencing in those early years. What has fundamentally changed?
Fundamentally, I'd have to say the number one thing that's changed is the acceptance of women in the world of surfing. My predecessors fought really hard, actually, just to be able to substantiate their position on the tour. And then when I came onto the tour in the early 90s, I felt like we'd lost the benefit of gender, because I felt like the girls, to earn the recognition and the respect and just the appreciation of their male counterparts and their peers, that they acted like men, they dressed like men, they tried to surf like men. And then there was this beautiful Californian girl called Lisa Anderson who came through and really broke down those gender barriers, and she embraced her femininity and she surfed like a girl and she dressed like a girl and she's a beautiful girl. From my perspective, when I came on tour, I really wanted to change women surfing and take it in a whole new level. Ultimately, my grand vision for women surfing was to replicate what they've done with women's tennis.
So explain that further, because I am fascinated by that idea of the benefit of gender. As someone who came through an engineering degree and women were pushing their gender away, they had to be there and be one of the guys.
Yeah, and there's time when you do have to play that game. There's nothing wrong with being one of the boys, and there's nothing wrong with having a driving force that's to prove somebody wrong. But the challenge is maintaining that connection to authenticity. Who are you authentically? Who is it that you want to be? What legacy that you want to create? create? How do you want people to feel when they are engaging with you? And how do you want people to talk about you, which is your personal brand, when you walk out of the room? And my number one value in my life is authenticity. What you see is what you get, wherever you find me. So what I've found with women surfing now is it's okay to be a woman in the water.
What does that mean? Because you use the expression surf like a girl. And a lot of girls would say, I don't surf like a girl. You know, I surf like a pro. What do you mean by that in the water?
Did you see that Always campaign online where they asked these kids to come in front of a camera and they said to these much older kids, run like a girl.
Oh, yes, I loved it.
Throw like a girl. And they all kind of ran all willy-nilly, you know. They threw their legs out and you know, tossed like they couldn't throw a ball even further than a metre. And then they asked young kids to come in and throw like a girl and run like a girl. And, you know, this girl was a judo champion. It was a matter of embracing femininity and accepting that it's okay to be a girl. You don't have to play like a boy or act like a boy or dress like a boy in order to be accepted as a girl. And so one of the things that I prided myself on as being one of the boys but still maintaining that authenticity as a girl in the water.
What does that mean in the water?
Well, it means wearing a bikini instead of board shorts. It means accepting that your surfing style is going to be different. It means that you're going to approach waves differently. It means actually you're going to be a little bit slower. And it means that you are just going to do things a little bit differently. You don't have to be one of the boys and do it just like a man.
Obviously, recognition of women in surfing in the professional circuit has increased. But and more girls are going to learn to surf classes, I gather.
Yes.
Has that, though, translated into more women competing professionally?
Well, it's definitely translated to more women in the water because I now see girls walking to school with their boards under their arms. And I remember when I was going to an all-girls public school when I went to high school, and my school teachers essentially even wrote on my school card, please lock up her surfboard, it's a distraction to her studies. And now surfing's on a lot of the curriculum in a lot of the schools, especially on the northern beaches of Sydney and in coastal towns around the country. So it's been accepted as a viable opportunity for women to aspire to become a professional at and ultimately can make a living from. You asked me at the start of this interview, what are the primary differences? Well, obviously prize money is one of them. When I retired from professional surfing, I'd been on the tour for a total of 19 years, almost 20 full years.
Your entire youth?
My entire youth, yeah. I completed high school, I got my HSC, and then I went on to the pro tour and committed myself to becoming a world champion. It took me 20 years on tour to earn $500,000 in prize money. This year alone, Stephanie Gilmore won her sixth world title and she had won over $250,000 in prize money. That's all in US dollars. So there's a huge difference in the earning potential for these women.
But is Steph Gilmore still an anomaly? Have the numbers of women on the waves, the fact that that's increased, has that translated into increased sponsorship?
Yes, absolutely. But it does also come down a little bit to the way that you look. And Steph's a natural beauty and she's well endorsed, she's well supported, and she's a beautiful girl. I think she's a great role model and an ambassador for women surfing.
Should it come down to the way you look, though, Lane Beachley?
Of course not. But unfortunately, that's how it works. But not entirely. I mean, there are some... Oh, God, everyone has something to offer, and you've just got to understand what is it that you offer and then sell that.
Lane Beachley is our guest on Life Matters this morning here on RN. We are talking to her because she has been awarded an AO as part of today's honours list. Woohoo, indeed. Woo-hoo. The nation is cheering for you, Lane Beachley, surfing legend. I mean, it's not just the financial hurdles.
Yeah.
Early on in your career, you copped chronic fatigue syndrome and it took a devastating toll. And many others would have been taken right off course with an experience like that. What kept you going? What kept you in the water?
My passion for surfing. Because I was out of the water for several months and I went into a state of depression and I lost my mojo, I lost my reason for living. And as far as I was concerned, when I had that second bout of chronic fatigue, which was definitely the most devastating and debilitating stage of the chronic fatigue syndrome, all I could focus on was what I was missing out on. And it's funny, when you're experiencing pain and heartbreak and disappointment and challenge, all you focus on is exactly that. And by focusing on that, you're actually prolonging that. You're prolonging the journey of that, the experience of that. And it wasn't until I first took responsibility for the fact that I have put myself in this situation. So for quite a while, because The reason
that's a tough thing to say. I mean, chronic fatigue lands in people's lives.
It is, but I understand that. But you've got to accept that you're responsible for your life. We are all self-fulfilling prophecies. The choices that we've made determine the outcomes that we have. When I looked on back in my life and I thought, well, you know, I need to make different choices about my diet. I need to start listening to my body more. I need to honour my health. I need to tone back my training. I need to get more sleep. I need to stop drinking. I need to improve all these elements of my life. And I know by doing that, that will improve my health. But if I'm going to get out of this alive, I have to make some drastic changes. I have to stop living in a life of hope and hoping things will change and start getting dissatisfied, because that's the precursor to positive change.
Well, you certainly did keep on living your life.
I certainly did.
In a big way. And
yes.
I remember when you were competing, you said, I'm the most competitive person on the planet.
At the time I was, yes.
And I'm wondering if you're still applying that particular impulse.
No, certainly not. And you've got to understand what your driving force is. And for me, my driving force was the fact that I was adopted. I had to prove to the world that I was deserving of love, because as far as I was concerned, being adopted meant you were given away. You were given up and you weren't worthy of love by your own mother. That was my perspective. Mm. That was my thought about it.
That's where that came from, that need to prove yourself.
Yes, that's what drove me to win 6 world titles. And so I remember when I did that quote on Australian Story on the ABC, that's when they asked me, yes, I'm the most competitive person on the planet. It was all because I was still driving and striving to succeed. And the struggle in life comes from what you expect and what life delivers you. And if your expectations are unrealistic and extreme too high, and then life can delivers you something below that, then that's where the struggle continues. And I was constantly in and out of struggle, because, yes, life was giving me what I wanted, but the torment and traumas and challenges that I went through to achieve that were sometimes way too much.
And I think people underestimate that dynamic in competitive people, that
yes.
internal struggle isn't often about the competition, it's often about something much deeper.
Yes, it is often much deeper, but most people don't take the time to identify what their driving force is, and so they just think they have to achieve it because that's what they want. But then we also know that wanting something and believing in something are two very stark contrasting ideals. And it's the belief that live in our subconscious mind that sometimes stop us from achieving our goals. So when I took the time to identify that I had a fear of rejection, that was my driving force, I wanted to be the best in the world because I wanted to prove a point, then I was able to channel it into something positive. But before that, I was actually utilising it as a form of self-sabotage.
Wow. You are helping other people achieve their goals now.
I am.
With the Lane Beachley Aim for the Stars Foundation. This is about more than women in sport, isn't it? It's about women in any endeavour that they choose to be passionate about. What's the ethos?
The ethos, well, our mission is to enable young girls and women to invest in their future and fulfil their potential. So we're all about empowering young girls to believe in themselves. And the great thing about Aim for the Stars is that we're supporting, mentoring and providing financial support to girls who have initiative and passion. They have a dream, they have the courage to ask for help, and we have the ability to provide that. And the catalyst for it was when I was number 2 in the world earning $8,000 a year working 4 different jobs up to 60 hours a week. It was a real challenge and I wanted to quit, and one of my employers said, here's $3,000, here's your next round the world air ticket, I believe in you. And if it wasn't for his belief in me, I wouldn't have gone on to achieve my goals. So I reflected on that after winning my 6th consecutive world title and went, you know, I want to start a foundation that prevents girls from quitting, that prevents girls from having to go endure that same level of financial hardship and adversity that I experienced, and that motivates them and inspires them, and also brings like-minded girls together and so they can become an alumni and empower each other and support each other through their journey.
So that's been running for over a decade now.
Yeah, we've been
what are your proudest
years.
Moments in that?
I mean,
what really stands out for you?
Every single one of them is amazing. We meet some incredible girls. We're actually about to announce 2015's recipients, because we get about 1,000 applicants a year. Unfortunately, because of our minimal amount of funding, we have to narrow it down to about 25 girls each year. But we have some incredible success stories. Casey Easton, who's a hockey player, was one of the first girls to ever receive a grant back in 2004, and she went on to be one of the leaders and captains of the Australian hockey team and has won Commonwealth Games gold medals and Olympic medals, and she's extraordinary. We've got Caroline Buchanan, who is a 5-time world BMX champion. We've got Emma Henschel, who we gave $3,000 to as an aerial trapeze artist.
Sporty emphasis.
Yes. Okay, so we do have a human rights lawyer, opera singer, The human rights lawyer is pretty special because she was born into a satanic cult, and these cults are actually legal in this country. And so what makes her special is she wanted to go to university and get a master's degree in human rights law so she could do what she could to shut these cults down. And so we gave her a grant. We actually gave her a grant a couple of years in a row, and we helped her graduate, and we went to her graduation because she has no family. The thing is that these cults continue to threaten her life. She's one of the most resilient, tenacious, inspirational women you'll ever meet. So we get all sorts of incredible women. We've got paediatricians. We've got basically, in this, through Aim for the Stars, we have an alumni of women who not only are changing their lives, but they're changing the world. And we're all about identifying the next leaders of this country.
Well, it's a long way from being a little grommet with your dad in the Manly surf at age four, isn't it?
It sure
Lane
is.
Beachley, congratulations. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
Thanks, Natasha. Thanks for having me.
Lane Beachley, she has been awarded an AO in today's Australia Day honours. We'll pop a link to the Lane Beachley Aim for the Stars Foundation on the Life Matters website if you'd like to spread the word about that. Perhaps you know someone who could benefit from that, someone who is aiming for the stars. Well, Natasha Mitchell, joining you this Australia Day here on Life Matters on ABC RN. Great to have your company. And another triumphant story. Next, the nonnas and the nanas are in the house. Stay with us.
Hi Fran, it's Patricia Carvelis here. Sorry to bother you on holidays. I'm starting drive and I'm kind of wanting to get some tips from you.
All right, well, golden rule is you've got to go to bed early because you've got to get up at 4 to be on air at 6.
But you know I'm on drive. It starts at 6 p.m.
Okay, bottom line, keen ears, inquiring minds. That's what you need to do the job and you'll be fantastic. Welcome aboard.
Patricia Carvelis on RN Drive begins tomorrow from 6.
Yes, indeed. Welcome, Patricia. In this era of mega supermarket chains and shopping centres the size of small nation states, it's easy to forget the value of that little corner shop, isn't it? The milk bar, the fruit shop. That's right where so many migrant families got their start in Australia and built their business acumen. They are places of neighbourhood stories and friendships, lots of gossip too. Writer Zoe Boccabella has delved into her family's own rich story to write Joe's Fruit Shop and Milk Bar, pieced together from 3 decades of listening to her grandparents' incredible stories of war, of internment camps here in Australia, of separation, of strength, and she joins us this Australia Day. Welcome, Zoe.
Hi, Natasha. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. This is a real reminder for me, I think, to talk to grandparents while they're still alive.
Yes, absolutely. I actually was very blessed to have all four of my grandparents alive for almost 3 decades of my life, and I just found it wonderful just listening to their stories, even from when I was a small child. It was just basically you'd be having dinner and then sitting around after dinner, and particularly my grandparents on my Italian side, they were just real storytellers and often told me just little snippets of what happened in their lives. Yeah, and it was quite wonderful.
And you started writing those stories down, which is how this has all come about.
Yes.
And this is a fairly dynastic story, in fact,
right,
because it crosses 4 generations back to your great-grandparents,
right, yeah,
who also came to Australia.
Yes. I was also very lucky that my great-grandparents were also alive, up, you know, till I was about aged 8, I think. So I knew them as well, yeah.
That's rare.
It
was a flood and, in fact, an earthquake that really was the catalyst for you writing this book, wasn't it? What happened?
Yeah, it was in January 2011 that we had the big flood here in Brisbane. And while my grandparents had both died by that stage, we still had a lot of their belongings and furniture and things like stored under their house, which was in New Farm, which is very close to the river.
Mm.
And the flood was just almost upon us, and you know, before we knew it was sort of coming to Brisbane, and we were over there sort of hurriedly trying to save a lot of their belongings, most of which we couldn't save, unfortunately.
But, and it's awful, wasn't it? I mean, people who were there will remember
absolutely
the water,
yeah,
creeping up slowly but surely, and people
exactly right,
just trying,
yeah,
to grab whatever they could in the time that they had.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, just as, I mean, the water ultimately did beat us. I mean, we were sort of loading up the what was my grandfather's old ute at the time, and to be able to get the cars out, we had to abandon a lot of things in the end. And yeah, just as we were walking away, you know, the water was sort of coming up to the house then, and I was walking back to the car, and I remember glancing back, and I just saw part of the old sign that had hung over the footpath in front of the shop, and it had milk bar in big letters on it, and fruit and sweets. And it sort of like, whilst I think I always knew I'd write about my grandparents' stories, but I think that was in part the catalyst to write this version of the book.
Mm. And the Italian earthquake was something of a prompt too, because stuff that was the sort of material history of your family had been lost in that earthquake too.
Yeah, it was quite incredible because we were very blessed to have my family's home in Italy still in the family and intact. And we actually would go over to stay there, and that's where I first really started delving into my Italian heritage in Italy. And yeah, within a few years, unfortunately, we had the earthquake in Abruzzo in 2009, and the house has been so badly damaged that it's now uninhabitable. And yeah, it was quite poignant in that my grandparents' belongings in Italy that were still in the house were sort of now under dust and rubble, and their belongings here in Australia were then succumbed to flood in the end. Mm. So, yeah, it was quite...
Let's meet these grandparents. A central character, Joe, your father's father, mm-hmm. Your grandfather, Annibale.
That's correct.
Joe. Yep. Because yeah. we're all about anglicising names.
And I think so many people just struggle to say Annibale. Like, yeah, it's just to get your tongue around it, I think, yeah, just made it much easier.
He was born in Mussolini's fascist Italy, and it's hard to imagine, I think, for people now. Here he was, 15 years old. He boards a boat for Australia. Why?
Well, he was really doing what his parents were asking him to do. By then, his father came to Australia when he was only, you know, still a baby in Italy, as in my grandfather was still a baby. And so he grew up in Italy not really knowing his father, because his father was over in Australia all that time. And it in those days, I mean, it was so hard to find work, especially with the Depression happening in Australia, and especially with my great-grandfather, Vitali. Like, he didn't have a lot of English. Well, I don't think he had any English when he first came here, but he found it very hard to try and save the fares for them to come over, and it took a very long time. And I think it was just a case of my grandfather got to the age of 15, and his parents said, well, you know, you're old enough to work, it's your turn to go over, and, you know, with the two of you working over in Australia, it will save the money then for, you know, his mother and his little brother to come and join them in Australia as well.
This is the striking aspect of this whole story, is that you get this sense of Italian women marrying young and then waiting faithfully in villages all over Italy for husbands to either return or to send them the fare to Australia. This, and sometimes for many years. I mean, your great-grandparents, in 26 years of marriage, until she got here, the great-grandmother, they'd only mm-hmm. spent 3 years together.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, I think, and what you're saying is right, there were a lot of people who married young and then were separated for many years, and there were unfortunate incidences where some men went overseas and just were never heard from again. They created new lives and got new wives overseas, and the poor women back in Italy just never heard a word from them again. In the case of my great-grandmother, Maddalena, she actually was very unusual in that she married a lot older. She was 30, mm. and which was quite unusual in those days in, you know, Abruzzo in 1923. So she was sort of considered an old spinster. So she was quite a feisty sort of character, and she had a little bit more freedom than some of the other women might have had in that. When her father died, she really helped out at her family's. They had a butchery and a grain mill. And so she had a little bit of freedom before she married. So she was quite a self-sufficient type of person. So while they were separated for many years, I think she was quite a figure in her little village there. And you know, I think as a community, they really leaned on each other, those women that were left behind.
Yeah, it is amazing that, you know, in 26 years of marriage, there they land together
And they've kind of got to reinvent their relationship in their 50s.
That must have been so strange, that first night when they were at the boarding house in Brisbane and they were sort of back together again after all that time, because, I mean, you're a very different person from the person, you know. I mean, they were separated for 17 years, I think, at one stretch there, and, you know, you would be a completely different person. While you had lots of things in common and you would have stayed in contact via letters, which in those days, you know, you'd be lucky to get a letter every couple of months or so.
The war was on as well.
Yeah, they were completely cut off during the war. There was no communication at all then, yeah.
So that's your grandfather's parents.
That's correct,
Joe's
yeah.
parents. So these are the four generations. Mm-hmm. So your grandfather Joe lands in Australia. How did he relate to his father? Did he talk about that? This father that he hadn't seen for most of his life?
Yeah, well, he told me that when he first arrived and he's on the ship and, you know, he's about to disembark from the ship in Brisbane here, and he could see his father in the crowd, and his father just turned and walked away. Like, his father didn't recognise him at all, because, of course, he'd been a small boy when his father had left, and then he actually had a photo with him of his father so he could recognise, you know, and then show him. But, his father actually walked away, and I think my grandfather then felt a little bit concerned because, I mean, here he was in this strange country and, you know, not much money at all, and you know, his father, who was the only person at that stage, you know, that he'd know here, has walked off, and he couldn't find him anywhere. But fortunately, his father then came on board the ship to see if he was on board, and I think he did a double take when he saw my grandfather, who was quite tall, whereas my great-grandfather, his father, was quite a short man, and I think he was quite shocked to see this sort of young man standing in front of him that was his son.
Mm. Joe, your grandfather, goes to work. I mean, this is hard physical labour for very little money. Effectively, he's still a kid. He heads to North Queensland to cut cane, and there's a whole story in itself because, of course, this is also the Second World War. Italian migrants are at risk of internment in camps. They were the enemy. Australians were fighting a war against them. What happened to Joe in that setting at that time?
Well, he actually, he headed up to Ingham at a time when, there was a lot of unrest amongst, you know, particularly, it was, you know, anti-Italian sentiment at the time, because by then Mussolini had brought Italy into the war, and you know, people were feeling a bit, understandably, Australians were feeling concerned that migrants would, you know, rise up against them. And, I mean, whereas in reality, a lot of the migrants had been there, you know, some of them 20 years, some of them were naturalised, some of them were born in Australia. And a lot of them had also left Italy to get away from fascism, so they certainly were not about to rise up and support it. My grandfather, he certainly ventured north during shaky times there, and I think once he found out, you know, that there was this sort of anti-Italian sentiment, I think he was quite surprised and a bit hurt initially.
Well, it was vicious at times. I mean, you describe headlines of, you know, the olive peril, the Dago menace, the olive trash. Did he talk about this with you?
Yeah, he did. And he said how, in particular, there was a newspaper called Smith's Weekly, which often was very anti-Italian. And I've seen some of the cartoon illustrations of Italians from that time, and I mean, it is, you know, quite anti-Italian, and always shows Italian men as sort of threatening and leering and big mustache, and they're sort of slashing their cane knife, you know, against these poor timid Australians. And so, you know, it was very contrived, but unfortunately I think where the sentiment was probably a lot more vicious in Queensland compared to some other areas of Australia, is there was already this existing, especially in the cane fields, almost this existing animosity towards, you know, the new migrants taking the jobs of the local Australians, and, you know, some of them starting to own cane farms, and they really felt like they were taking over. So while it was partly stemming from, you know, anti-Italian sentiment during the war, it was also exacerbated from an already existing sort of resentment or animosity to do with taking jobs.
Yes, indeed. Zoe Boccabella is our guest here on Life Matters on Australia Day. She's written a really striking memoir that tells the story primarily of her grandparents. It's called Joe's Fruit Shop and Milk Bar. Her grandfather came out here as a kid, one of the many Italian migrants that made Australia home. And so to the internment story, because Joe, your grandfather, avoided being put in an internment camp, didn't he?
Yes.
With all his will and might.
Yes.
But that didn't work out.
No, I mean, I think he got a lot of his feistiness from his mother, and he was going, by that stage, you know, he was classified as an enemy alien, had been fingerprinted and photographed, and he had to report into the local police station once a week. And this particular day that he went to report in, one of the other, actually the leader of his cane gang, was just arrested, just standing there in the clothes that he wore and taken away. And he had a split moment to decide, what's he going to do? And my grandfather decided, I'm not going to be taken in, I'm going to run. And and so he got his bag and he got on a train and he took off from Ingham, and he went back to the farm he was working on, or near the farm he was working on in Stanthorpe, where his father was working. And he just stopped reporting into the police station. So this lasted, however, only a few months. And then in 1942, the war really started to escalate and affect Australia, and the fact that we had the fall of Singapore and then the bombing of Darwin. And then they really escalated the internment of Italians. So that's when it ended for him, in that he was then taken in and taken out to an internment camp.
The fact that he'd been a member of the fascist youth group in Italy, as so many young people were, it was what you did. Did that have any part to play in his internment, do you think, or was it simply because he was Italian?
No, just for being Italian at this stage. You know, he left that behind in Italy, as in he never attended any fascist meetings in Australia. He just, you know, he was never in sort of any groups, you know, that were pro-fascist or anything like that at all. No, he was just among, you know, different farmers or different farmhands working on farms at the time around the Stanthorpe area, and they just took a lot of them in. Yeah.
Did he talk about the internment experience? Did he feel any bitterness towards it as he went on to build his life, which we'll touch on very briefly now? But did that history leave him embittered?
No, he was actually very sort of accepting of it. He said, you know, he'd say, oh, look, you know, of course you resented it. And, you know, he lost some of the time when he was in the prime of his life and could have been, you know, working and earning good money. And, you know, and he was sort of stuck in this internment camp, not being able to do very much. But he was quite sort of accepting of it, in that he accepted it was a time of war and these things happened in a time of war. And he always insisted that the guards in the camp treated them well. I mean, it was very crude living conditions, because he wasn't in a, by then the camps were full, so he was actually just in a camp of tents and very rough, bush living, with a lack of, you know, it's quite a lack of sanitation. But I mean, he was accepting that, you know, well, this is war, and, you know, there was a lot of other people in a lot of worse situations. So
let's come briefly and finally to the shop that they, Francesca arrives, of course. They meet, they marry, this is your grandmother, they settle in Brisbane, they build a shop, his dream, I think, I wonder if it was hers, a fruit shop and a milk bar in the heart of Brisbane, long hours, no holidays. You had some trouble trying to get your father to talk about the impact of living in this sort of situation, because it was very demanding on him too, your own dad, son.
And I think this is common for a lot of migrant families, where you have the situation with the migrants really, you know, determined to carve out that new life, or, you know, some stability in a new country. And then you've got the first generation that are then born in the new country. And you know, it was very hard, because, I mean, the shop opened pretty much every day from 7 a.m. and off until 10 or 11 at night. They never hired anyone. It was always strictly the family there. So my father was there from the time they started off as a fruit stall, basically on the side, on the footpath, and he was there in a pram. And like, they went through then you know, they had the shop for the next 23 years. So he in effect grew up with the shop and working shifts in the shop from a very young age. But I think what he found hard was the family life was really affected in that, you know, it was because there was always someone at the shop, they never could sit down to a family meal together. And I think he really missed that. And it's interesting, but then when I was a child, it was always very, you know, we always had that family meal together at night because I think he'd missed that and so made sure he had it with his family.
It was a busy life. It was ultimately a very successful life, and it's a very joyous book too. And this is your second book. Your first was Mezza Italiana, which explored your feelings about being a hybrid, you know, half Australian, half Italian. I wonder, in writing this book, just briefly, what it's done for your own sense of self now in really teasing out this grandparent story.
Yes, I mean, I feel very humbled and very grateful for everything that my grandparents went through in coming to Australia and, you know, starting a new life here. I mean, I'm, you know, obviously I'm born in Australia, but I've always had that sort of thing of feeling half and half because you've got that Italian heritage as well, and you're sort of a little bit caught between two cultures. You know, it's funny, when you go to Italy you feel very Australian, and sometimes when you're in Australia you can feel very Italian, you know, when you have the sort of different traditions and that sort of thing at home. But I think writing about their lives, and I was really determined just to preserve that history because I just think, you know, it's just so incredible, their story and the things that they had to go through and put up with in those days. And they did so, you know, they just with such acceptance and strength and forbearance. And, yeah, I really admire that.
Well, it's a great story to discuss on Australia Day. I think it'll connect with so many people. And the Italian community is so vibrant and large in Australia. We want to go out on a track. And it's a track that you've selected for us. Tell us briefly about it. Introduce it for us.
Okay. It's called Va Pensiero by Verdi. And it means a lot to me because we actually, it was sung by the Verdi Choir at my grandfather's funeral, which is held in the cathedral in Brisbane. And a few years back now, and it's quite a stirring piece, and every time I hear it I get quite emotional actually when I think of my grandfather and just the life he lived.
I'm going to let you go and pull out the tissues and, thanks so much for joining us on Australia Day, Zoe Boccabella.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Joe's Fruit Shop and Milk Bar, it's published by ABC Books, and let's take it away with Verdi. Verdi's Va Pensiero. And on Life Matters, we've been hearing one Australian migrant story, and we're coming now to present-day experiences. That was a history story. This is more current, and I wonder, when you get in a taxi, do you, like me, often strike up a conversation with the driver and find that amongst the students and long-time taxi drivers, there are also people with PhDs, engineers, doctors, scientists, accountants. Australia's cab drivers are a multi-talented population, but it's a job that many newly arrived migrants start with because it's the only one that they can get. And joining me this morning on Life Matters is Dr. Behan Ahmed, an Eritrean refugee who came to the country in the 80s. He's now a senior research fellow in land and ecosystem science at the University of Melbourne. He researches termites, I gather, which I'm very interested in. He's chair of Victoria's African Think Tank, and he was also the first African-born immigrant to run for parliament as part of the Voice for the West group, which ran an upper house ticket in the recent Victorian state election, you might recall, if you're listening in Victoria. In 2009, he was the Victorian Australian of the Year. And also joining us is Kath Scarth, who's CEO of what's called AIMS. They're a statutory authority of the Victorian state government, which provides migrant and refugee settlement services. Behan and Kath, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Natasha.
Thanks, Natasha.
Behan, let's go back to when you arrived in Australia, because this is partly about your story as well as your advocacy. You were a refugee from Eritrea, and yes, you found that your qualifications in agriculture just weren't recognised. So what did it take to get established, to get work?
Well, Natasha, it's a long story, but starting getting yourself into the system is quite a challenge. It's a network. Any qualification, any experience, without having the network, without having the people, it's quite challenging. As a refugee at the time, it was hard even to find, to rent a flat, because you need a reference. You, with all the qualification, no one would give a damn. You have to have a paper to get into the place. To get a job, the same thing. And I went to University of Melbourne at the time to get myself to do, if I can't get anything, let me start studying. And they asked me to go for overseas qualification assessment. In fact, science is science wherever you go. But still, our system has got a systemic discrimination, I would say, because it is not as open as we wanted it. As we always talk about multiculturalism, welcoming, but our system at times has got a very
blinkers,
rigid.
Those blinkers.
Yes.
And did the university receive you?
Not at the time. I went and, as you said, then I went, to be honest with you, was starting in a factory, the good old days of you know, the manufacturing industry where I started. But then I can't live, you know, just playing with a machine and no one to talk to. Then I went and I was catching a tram and I said to the tram conductor, how did you get the job? He said to me, well, you got to, you know, near Collins Street at the time, Spencer Street, Collins Street used to be the head office of the Metropolitan Transport. And I went there and I asked them, I want to work as a tram conductor. They, you know, the receptionist laughed at me and said, you don't even speak good English. How would you work? I said, well, let me try. And if I can, she gave me a form. I filled it and I came. They asked me for an aptitude test, which at the time, the aptitude test they gave me was just very sort of rudimentary. It was very basic mathematics, you know, 2 + 7 × 4, whatever, something. It was very simple. I passed it.
Yeah.
And then they called me for an interview, and this is where the challenge people have forced to lie. I was standing in the interview, three, you know, senior members of the tram transport were asking me, have you got any experience? I said, I never had experience. I even saw a tram in my life. But I have to say, I was working as a conductor in Sudan. They said, that's good. and then they asked me, you know, they say, well, you know, in this country, we've got people come in at night, drunk and whatever, so what do you do? I said, well, if I've got 100 people and one is drunk, I will take the $99 and I will leave the $1 free. They said, that's a great answer. And they saw that, you know, with all the lie that I put, because I didn't have a reference, I didn't have anywhere, no, but I have to stand and convince them. So that gave me a chance to break one end into getting myself into the system.
So you became a connie, as they were, of course,
I
affectionately
did.
Called then.
I did.
A taxi
did.
Driver as well.
I did. In fact, Natasha, on that point, I learned English while I was paid working. I learned the culture and I made friends. People going every day on Sydney Road to the city at the time, they all became my friends.
Through your community leadership today, and I can't believe the number of different hats you wear, a scientist, an advocate, a, you know, wannabe politician by the sounds, but would you say that the situation is the same? Certainly we've seen the numbers of African migrants and refugees grow in Australia. Are they facing precisely the same barriers and lack of recognition of existing qualifications in some cases as you did?
Unfortunately, as a country, we moved from manufacturing economy to knowledge and service economy. The manufacturing economy does not need someone to speak from the airport straight to the city with English. You can't put Windows 2014 or 15 in your head and change. It's a human change. People cannot have English overnight. In knowledge and service economy now, everyone is expected to speak from day one English. From day one, to have skills, to be a cleaner, the requirement is very sophisticated. Back then, there was, and this is what I say in the whole process, now we need a sort of, like the US, a positive discrimination, or what do they call it in US, that they, you know, the African Americans, and for women, they did a positive discrimination to allow them to get into the system. Mm. Africans in Australia, especially black Africans, we're the first to be in this country. We don't have a long history like the Chinese and others who have got roots in the system. We don't.
Yes, indeed. And you've actually, I mean, one way people is that they start with their own businesses. So they bypass all the existing employment infrastructure and they go and focus on small businesses. And you've launched an Australian African Small Business Association there in Victoria. Let me come now to Kath Scarth, CEO of AIMS, because this is right at the heart of what you do. A migrant settlement agency running a skilled professional migrant program. Mm. So you know very closely this lack of recognition of existing skills, don't you? Is it very, very real and alive still?
That's right, Natasha. I think, as Burhan said, it's not just the skills, the qualification or the English. I think it's that lack of networks and connections that new arrivals have. Many jobs aren't advertised. It's who you know. They're not advertised through the media and so on. And most of us have connections and networks here who can help us get that first foot in the door, which is so critical. And not always. And migrants and refugees themselves don't expect to come in at the top all the time, but they do want to be on a clear pathway so that they can move through those perhaps lower skilled jobs, but ultimately into jobs that uses their expertise, as Burhan's story so eloquently shows.
So, are people aware, though, when they're coming here, that their qualifications might not be recognised? Do they have realistic expectations?
I don't think so. I think they expect that. They realise that they might need to start slightly lower than when they left their home country. But I think generally people expect to come here and for their skills and experience to be acknowledged and utilised. And I think that's one of the things that they quickly realise, that getting a job here in Australia isn't perhaps the same as where they came from. And they kind of really need to learn those skills. It's not just about their qualifications and experience, but it's actually how you get work in Australia. And so the Skilled Professional Migrant Program is very much about trying to, in a pretty intensive way, people want to get on and get work. They don't want to necessarily sit in classrooms for very long. Yeah. But it's connecting skilled professionals to big employers and the corporate end of town to help them understand what employers are looking for, how to go through an interview here, that often many migrants will say to me, I don't understand. They didn't ask me about my qualifications and skills. They wanted to know all of these other things, like, you know, how I work in a team or how I would solve a certain problem. And they're just not expecting that.
So it's about networks, but it's also about all those other aspects of operating in a workplace in an Australian context.
That's right. And not just to get the job in the first place, but to be able to keep it. It's all of those things, and then to move up the career ladder, so that what we don't have is whether people have come through the migrant program or the refugee program, but people who have great skills and experience aren't stuck in low-paid, low-skilled jobs when really they have much more to offer. And for a country who really needs to grasp the opportunities that this group are giving us, and so employers can benefit.
Yes.
If they think in a different way.
Burhan Ahmed from the African think tank there, I mean, I can hear you agreeing along the way. And I mean, certainly, as we mentioned earlier, one pathway that people take is that they set up their own businesses. How vital is that in terms of the African community making their way forward?
Well, Natasha, this is critical because given all the experiences that we tried, especially now for us, the crisis is we got a new generation coming, graduating from Australian universities and not going anywhere. And, you know, and this anyone could say now, well, the same for Australian young graduates. But I can tell you, I'm at Melbourne University. Out of 10, if we get two employed, in the mainstream there is about out of 10, you get 6 to 7 people employed. 3 may not get. But in our case, we get 8 to 9 people not employed. So the question is getting critical for us. These young people has to be engaged, has to see the light at the end of the day that they are part of this society and they need to engage in economic participation. And this is why the African businesses and others that we're trying to catalyze to grow and absorb and give hope to the young generation. Because sitting and putting our hand and waiting for someone to solve the problem for us took so long, and we're losing young generation in many ways, be it in crime, be it in many other drug and other problems. It is costing the society at large.
And Kath, you've seen some interesting examples of refugee communities particularly focused on setting up businesses, haven't you?
That's right. Refugees often are incredibly entrepreneurial. In terms of getting themselves here, it's been an amazing journey. And as Burhan says, I think what they're realising quickly is they need to put those skills to use here as well, not just think that they'll find work elsewhere. And so most of the communities we work with are setting up businesses. There's some great stories.
Like great examples. Give us one very, very briefly.
So a fantastic supermarket in Dandenong with a Hazara set up a small corner store 5 years ago, I think, when he first arrived, now has a very large supermarket employing not just Afghanis, but other people from the community. So, you know, they work hard and very quickly will become significant employers in their community.
There's a Burmese woman in Horsham, is that right, as well?
So it's
that was a great
it's actually
yarn.
Yes, so this is a lover duck who are a large duck exporter in Nil, north of Horsham, weren't able to grow their business a few years ago, and working with us we resettled a number of Karen Burmese up there, started as employees, and they're now they've now established and are working in their own small business, feeding, providing ducklings or ducks to Lover Duck. So it's that very entrepreneurial spirit, which, you know, as I said, we're missing out on if we don't learn how to maximise early on.
Natasha, if I could add one word on that one. Refugee and myself, we come with one-way ticket. We don't have an option. We have to make it work. And that's the determination of every refugee coming here. There's no to look back. And I'm sorry to say, a migrant has got a ticket, he can go back. But a refugee, and according to the census, in every 5, at least 2 or 3 migrants go back. In every 100, you won't find 1 or 2 refugee going back. Because refugees are here for good because they come with one-way ticket and had to make it work. And starting from myself, I didn't have a choice to look any other ways but to make it work. And everyone is in that mood, wanting to make things work. But what they need is just an access to opportunity. Yes. Not charity.
And as we've talked about, that's it right. can happen at a number of levels, setting up your own business, but also employers yes. need to take some focus here too. And Absolutely. Then there's the political line. And, of course, you've tried running for politics. Good luck if you try and do that again. Look, thank you, both of you, for joining us briefly, too briefly, I think, this Australia Day. I appreciate it very much. Behan Ahmed of the African Think Tank and Kath Scarth, CEO of AIMS, who provide migrant and refugee settlement services. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Thanks, Natasha.
Appreciate it.
And we'll put details of both on the Life Matters website. Thank you so much for your company today. Hope you have a great one. Looking forward to your company next on Life Matters. You know, the cost of attending uni, it's up in the air. We're going to discuss that and open up the phone lines as well. Coming up to the news, thank you for your company today. Natasha Mitchell saying bye for now.